Subcommittee of the House Streams and Restorations and Species Recovery Committee, for want of a quorum for the whole committee. And first on our agenda today, we'll take, things a little out of order because, Valerie Johnson Eads, is that correct, would like to, or has a need to, get to another assignment, another commitment. And we call then, Valerie to the stand. And, Valerie's with, Save Our Salmon Coalition. Thank you. Welcome.
It would help if I hit the chair, wouldn't it?
One word of advice for everybody, that comes up to testify, and you just violated it before I got started. Don't move the microphone. They scraped in my ear as we, go across. They're pretty sensitive. You shouldn't need to, have to speak directly in them.
Yeah, she's on your bad side already, huh?
I tell you, what can I say?
I'll try to make up for it here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my apologies.
That's right.
Good afternoon to members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. I am Valerie Johnson Eads, Representative King. Nice to see you. I'm speaking to you today on behalf of the Save the Salmon Coalition as one of its co-chairs. I have submitted a packet of information about the coalition, which includes a list of the 10 initial members, a list of some of the fishery scientists we rely on, and a two-page statement describing our approach to salmon issues and a bill request relating to the wild fish hatchery issue. I'd like to point out that Mike Stewart with the Oregon State Grange is in the audience also today as part of our testimony, and I'm assuming some of our other coalition members will be dropping by. As you can see from the makeup of the coalition, it represents a broad spectrum of interests, primarily landowners, farmers, tree growers, and others who are concerned about the impact of regulations that restrict the use of land. Most of the members of the coalition generally do not be very involved in water or fish-related issues. So why are we here today? The reason is that as the Oregon Plan and NIMS salmon programs evolved, it became clear to us that they pose serious threats to many landowners and natural resource users, whether it be restrictions on farming and grazing, more prohibitions on forest harvesting, dam removals with adverse impacts on irrigation and transportation, or wide unjustified buffer strip areas in urban areas, in urban areas that adversely impact housing and other developments. These concerns caused us to do some research into the justification for the Oregon Plan and the National Marine Fisheries Service programs and the direction they are headed. Frankly, what we found was shocking. We found that current salmon policies and programs are flawed and wrongheaded, that they are needlessly putting excessive controls on human activities in watersheds, and that they are, frankly, bad for salmon. We decided to work together to bring about sensible policies and programs for both watersheds and salmon. I would like to briefly tell you about our findings and recommendations. First, as we explain more fully in the packet I have submitted to you, we became convinced that NIMS should not have listed salmon as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. NIMS did not count hatchery fish, which NIMS itself admits are genetically identical to the so-called wild fish it did count. If hatchery fish had been counted, NIMS could not have justified the listing. In fact, NIMS did count hatchery fish in making a salmon listing determination on the East Coast. And I do have a copy of that NIMS document, or a court document, if any of you would like to see a citation on that. It is hard for us to believe that Chinook, Coho, and Steelhead are threatened when over 500,000 passed through Bonneville Dam going upriver at about the same time NIMS listed them, and returns this past year have been dramatically higher. Second, we found many eminent fishery scientists who strongly oppose the current wild fish policies that are dominating both state and federal fish programs, including the Oregon Plan. Six of these scientists are listed in the packet you have received this from us this afternoon, I believe on the second or third salmon-colored page, second salmon-colored page. They are retired or semi-retired and free to speak their minds based on lifetimes of experience and research. And I would add a footnote there that we are finding that scientists who are still full-time employees are very reticent to venture into this political arena. There is much pressure on them to stay out of the discussion, regardless of how strongly they feel about this, and they're feeling very concerned for their program. So for the most part, they are not willing to become involved. So we've reached out to these retired scientists who are becoming more and more active as they see more clearly what is going on. They believe we should have sensible and balanced salmon policies that rely on both naturally spawned salmon and hatchery salmon. Three of these scientists are scheduled to testify at your Friday hearing this week on February 2nd as invited testimony. Third, we found from our research that salmon recovery programs are focusing entirely, or almost entirely, on improving river watersheds while virtually ignoring the food condition, ocean conditions, and ignoring the predator predation problem, which appear to have far more impact than watershed and habitat. When you find that for every 100 fish that reach the ocean, roughly one or two fish actually return, common sense tells you that a good salmon recovery program ought to be looking at what's happening to the 98 or 99 that did not return. Consider the impact of predators. We understand that major predators such as seals and sea lions have increased dramatically since the early 1900s, from a few thousand, literally 4,000 or 5,000, to over 600,000 today. Anyone who visits the Oregon coast can see ample evidence of this. I'm sure you have all read about the millions of smolts Caspian terns have taken near the mouth of the Columbia River. Cormorants take many fish as well. We find that all those predators are protected species and as of today, cannot be controlled regardless of the impact that they're having on our salmon populations. Consider the impact of ocean conditions and food supply. The huge returns of salmon this past year and expected again this current year are powerful evidence that ocean conditions, whether food sources or fishing, have a great deal to do with the variations in salmon populations. Consider a recent study by Dr. Bill McNeil, who is one of the scientists that will be testifying to you on Friday, that we have made available to your committee. It was a study of 23 rivers and streams that had been rated good, fair, and poor for salmon productivity by the management agencies themselves. The good rivers were relatively pristine, and the poor rivers were far more impacted by human activity. Much to the surprise, and I might add a second footnote, the dismay of some, the study revealed that the poor streams actually outproduced the good streams, indicating that the pristine streams lacked nutrients fish need. In other words, the streams that are presumed to have the most problem with fish because they have the most human activity on them actually were supporting greater fish populations than the pristine streams and the lack of human activity. Dr. McNeil will be here on Friday and would welcome your inquiry of him on that study. We understand fisheries agencies are now putting dead fish carcasses back in the streams to provide nutrients, and I believe that could be verified by Fish and Wildlife testimony. We also find that government agencies simply do not have the scientific justification for some of the regulatory restrictions they are imposing in watersheds. There simply is not data to support that if we follow the restrictive regulations, that it will bring back the fish, or any quantitative study on how many fish it will bring back. They simply have imposed it, I guess, on a hunch. And they cannot prove that imposing the restrictions will have a significant positive effect on salmon populations, certainly not as much as sensible hatchery policies, predator controls, and ocean cycles and conditions. To further support the coalition's approach to salmon issues, we have presented a written statement by Dr. Ben Stout, who is a retired scientist with a long career researching, educating, and working in the natural resource environmental arena. Dr. Stout had wished to be here today but had a conflict he was unable to reschedule. He became deeply involved in the salmon issue after serving as a consultant on a state-funded study of coastal salmon, and therefore devoted a great deal of volunteer time to research and analysis of salmon issues. Some of the highlights of Dr. Stout's statement stress the fact that hatchery salmon are the same as naturally spawned or wild salmon, and challenges attempts to distinguish between them. They are the same species. They interbreed, they reproduce. Dr. Jim Lannan, who will be here on Friday, can speak more specifically to that as an expert in fish genealogy. Fish genetics. Dr. Stout also strongly challenges the determination that salmon are near extinction. He includes a graph showing that, overall, returns of Chinook salmon in the Columbia River over the past 60 years have not declined. There have been considerable variations on a year-to-year basis. He also points to evidence that variation in salmon returns are about the same in all rivers, regardless of variations in river conditions. Again, following along the same line as Dr. McNeil's paper has indicated, indicating ocean conditions rather than river conditions are the cause of the variations. He includes a graph correlating returns of Chinook on the Rogue and the Columbia. And finally, he urges public policies that are based on accurate monitoring, reliance on sensible hatchery policies, and utilization of unoccupied river habitats. In closing, I'd like to stress that while I realize the hearing today is for comments and update on the Oregon Plan, that our testimony to you is to highlight our concern that the Oregon Plan and its extenuating regulations is based on this wild fish as a priority over hatchery fish, that genetically they are identical fish, that there is not the scientific evidence showing us why that preference should be given to the wild fish, and in fact there is much scientific evidence indicating that the preference is completely flawed. We believe a high priority for your committee should be to revise Oregon statutes, including the Oregon Plan, to remove the clear bias in favor of wild or naturally spawned fish and against hatchery fish. While there are some statutes that do provide for a balanced approach, many others do not. We've included in the coalition's package a bill request that would solve the problem by amending sections that include the wild fish bias.
Okay. At this point, I'm going to close the subcommittee of the Streams and Restoration and open the full committee. With this, we'd ask, are there any questions? One of the questions that I think I had, Valerie, do you have a source for your data on the 650,000?
That was a research paper done by a man named Don Dobbs, who is a researcher, and I don't have it on me, Mr. Chairman, but I'd be happy to supply it to you. He took it from Fish and Wildlife's own documentation. I believe we can cite back to that source.
Okay,
be happy to get that to your administrator
Thank
if
you
like.
Representative King.
Just a comment that, and it's very good to see you. I am concerned about the scientists that are outspoken and feel that they would be, criticized. That it's real important that we hear from, scientists how their facts come out, and what they believe because of their facts. I would be real concerned about. As I think everybody on the committee would be, that we don't want to get one side or the other only. We need all the facts. And I realize that, peer pressure is invisible sometimes, and you can't just do that. But I know we need the facts. We need all the facts.
I appreciate that. Representative King, I would suggest possibly on Friday that the panel of three scientists you'll have before you, while they won't, I would doubt that they would give you names of other people to speak with. They could... they would be, I think, a very credible place for you to ask that question, how significant a problem it is, because they are the ones from that community that have private conversations with others, and it's really kind of to some degree our reliance on what they're hearing, but also as we contacted some other folks, they just are not willing to get involved with it. But I would also say it goes beyond academia and goes even into the fish and wildlife bureaucracy itself. There are clearly people within the agency who are very upset that this wild fish policy is being pursued the way it is, but are, in fact, I've spoken to one myself personally, that are absolutely not going to speak out for fear of retribution.
Other questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for appearing before the committee, and we'll look forward to talking to you later in the session. Thank you. At this point, I think we're going to call the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs and Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation up. I believe you're coming all together, is that correct? Or whatever is the format that you have for us, Lily, we will be happy with. And recognize then Lily Pitt, Director of Government Affairs, Michael Mason, who is the counsel, I think, for the Warm Springs Tribes in this area, and Audie Huber with the Umatilla Indian Reservation, for Intergovernment Affairs Manager there.
Lawrence, good afternoon. Chairman Benson, my name, for the record, Louis Pitt, Jr., and correction, Michael Mason is tribal lobbyist for the one.
Tribal lobbyist.
We pay the tribal attorney almost as much as we do him.
Okay.
Chairman, yeah, this is reminds me of a situation back on the days when your relatives were first coming over here, when a bunch of folks rounded up, and of course in Indian country, that's just about anywhere, according to us, is, and they heard some drums starting to beat, and some of your relatives sitting around the fire and said, I don't like the sound of that. And then out from the darkness came a voice, give us a break, we're just breaking in a new drummer. So I would like to just go through some overheads and try to again squeeze the thousands of years of our people into just a few minutes and talk about this. Again, we're a treaty tribe. The Warm Springs Confederated Tribes are treaty tribes, and so are the Umatillas, and intact, haven't been broken. I don't speak for them. They don't speak for us. Sometimes we get together and just like why we're here with the state is we have very, at times, we have mutual interest resources, and the treaty that we negotiated, the contract, stemmed from the presence of thousands of years of our people being in this area. And as soon as we get the thing hooked up, just give me the high sign. And so within those thousands of years is that we did have full-fledged governments. A lot of folks looked at the tribal governments in a kind of a way as almost inferior, not a chance. I would think that the time would be the test of the success of our tribal governments. They've been here since what we call time immemorial. Apologize for not having a handout at this time is that I talked with Chairman Olney Pat, and he says, well, just get the conversation started, and we would hope that this would be the start of, I think, a more focused discussion about some of the issues that you folks want to learn about. It's a real treat for you folks to learn what's going on in Indian country and us using our rights. You've got to focus in real quickly to the, Chairman, I don't know how much the microphone's going to pick me up over here. Committing to time immemorial again, that our tribe, this was a good luck. Again, we had full-fledged authorities of tribal governments, of any government. We made executive decisions, we made law, we legislated actions, and we carried those out, made the justice decisions through the judicial type of systems. Life was good. This was down on the Columbia River, Deacon Rock, if you can recognize that. This was painted by Paul King in 1847. And once again, it's in 1847. The point, what is the state fitting a lot of this? Is that in 1847, the state was a territory, and title had yet to be relinquished from the tribal owners through the United States. So that's where treaties came in, is giving up of 10 million acres for the Warm Springs tribe, giving up 10 million acres of land current for living up to the treaty with the United States and its republics, the states. One of the documents that firms this up is, this is what the United States Continental Congress has stated in 1787, that the utmost good faith should always be observed towards the Indians, and that's relatives of mine, and relatives of Don Sampson, and relatives of Otis Hubers. Their lands and property will never be taken from them without their consent. Our lands, our properties, and consent, not consultation, not communications, not collaboration, consent, when it comes to these lands and properties. And in their property, rights, and liberties, they shall never be invaded or disturbed unless in just and unlawful war is authorized by Congress. A formal relationship with the United States government. And so on. And laws, honor, and justice, and humanity shall from time to time be made for preventing wrongs being done to them and for preserving peace and friendship with them. I have to remind some of the folks that rat down on the Columbia River occasionally. I work for the Gorge Commission. Remember the peace and friendship? Here's what I depicted as almost like my job description, trying to get better relations between. Here's the land. Here's roughly the 10 million acres that we gave to the United States. We gave up title to 10 million acres to the United States of America in turn for treaty rights. And those treaty rights, I'll show those in just a minute. Treaties are said to be contracts between two entities. In this case, a treaty is a contract between the Middle Oregon Tribe of Middle Oregon Treaty of 1855, at that time was in the Columbia River area, the Warm Springs in Alaska. And today we have a confederacy with the Paiute folks. Is that the reservation, as you can see here in red, is roughly 650,000 acres. We're not only talking about the reservation. Here's a point for some of the new folks, the new donors here, is that we have treaty rights off reservation. And the reservation rights itself is all exclusive use. That's guaranteed in the treaty, exclusive use of said reservation. This 10 million acres that we gave to the United States, we gave title to the United States, but reserved uses of those, fishing, hunting, carrying on as we've done on those lands for thousands of years. There's four statuses of land, the exclusive use land, the ceded area land, and another one guaranteed by treaty called the usual and accustomed. Usual and accustomed, landfall. Usual and accustomed area, Huckleberry Fields up in Trout Lake area, up in Washington, near Mount Adams. Good eating areas over in the, down by the Burlington area, down the towards Klamath Falls, usual and accustomed sites for us to use, guaranteed by treaty. And our attorney tell us the snapshot is what happened in 1855. If you were doing it in 1855, you could do it. Our elders say, no. So we have a little difference between what we think law is and kind of what the traditional Indians look at it today. There's a fourth category of where our folks traveled from, just like the explorers did, I think, in any society, any civilization, is that they travel from Canada to Mexico to, we think, even the East Coast. Also, look at this. This is also, this is one of the things I show tribal council to say. We got to start working with the state. This was part of the discussion I had back in '93. Why should we be working with the state? They're always a competing government. If we really care about our way of life, Savini people, we have to work with land managers. State, we have federal people, rather. We have the Madrid National Forest. We have the Moana National Forest on this side. We have the Shoes, the Orchipo, Mount here, Palau. Also, in the brownish color right here, that's the Bureau of Land Management. And then the grassland here, and all of the white part, all of the non-colored part here is state property, state, where state has authority either in county or private property. So if we're talking about a watershed, let's say that's one of the upper issues in this area, if we want to be helping ourselves manage this whole watershed, we have to deal with, looks like two federal agencies, state agencies, of committees, counties, different committees of those areas, and private property people to be having a whole interest to the land. The treaty itself, again, there's nothing quite like Indian law. I keep losing these things. They bear with me on this. That's the exclusive right of taking fish in the stream. This is the treaty that was negotiated between the United States and Joel Palmer, who resided right near here, that was the United States Indian region. That the exclusive right of taking fish in the streams running through and bordering said reservation was secured by the said Indian. And at all other usual and accustomed stations, again, that didn't take an act to be necessarily on reservation or in the ceded area. It can be off reservation. Well, that is all. In common to citizens of the United States and of erecting achievable house of procuring the same kind of fish, and also the privilege, to, we believe, not privilege, but right, of hunting, gathering roots and berries, and pasturing their stock on unsettled land, in common with citizens is secured to them. These are the rights, again, remember in contract, Chairman, in contract negotiations, is that sometimes you put stuff in your contract that you're really worried about, but you don't give up the rights that you kept for yourself. We did not give up, as the Indian Nation, give up the rights to a whole lot of things out there, and certainly that is our rationale when it comes to cultural resources and when it comes to burial sites. Measure 7 is one of those things that scares us because we're not quite sure what it means when it comes to, I think, our new neighbors helping us protect, I think, our way of life, which includes the respect for the my relatives of the past. So Measure 7 is something that comes into there. And again, land use is, I'm a gorge commissioner, and I wouldn't be there if I didn't believe in land use. And where should Oregonian be concerned today about, you know, the interface with Indians? This is the old footprint from years and years ago. Now you have 9 federally recognized tribes, certainly 2 of them in a strong position with treaties. And still yet we have rights. And our footprints are everywhere. This is our country. Some of our old time estate still is. And again, here's our folks, the Cascade folks, the Wasalas, the Wascopons, the Lions, the Shinos, the Unitillas, Cayuse. Let's be careful, you're getting into Audi's territory and Donald's here, so but that's first. One of the main things that I think that we have to think about is where do we fit in the whole scope of what we're trying to do. I just, we had a meeting with Bonneville Power Administration. We're going to have a terrible power year in our water year because of, not because of California, but because of the lack of water. How can we help ourselves in such a responsibility as people of the Northwest? Indians, tribal nations have treaties, that's a powerful tool, but we can't do it alone. Now, I think that Donald Jackson, John Platt, we talked a little bit about regional approaches. The tribe of Warm Springs has a number of wonderful projects. We haven't sat around and wait for the state of Oregon to take the lead. We've taken the lead ourselves. We have a number of projects that we've been, all the way from Hood River to the Wild and Scenic River Plant that we've done with the Lower Deschutes, Upper Deschutes, to the Colleys River, the John Day. We have an office in John Day. Sean Robertson is out there. He's actually from John Day. We're asking and pushing volunteer type of work with the local riparian folks. And again, one of those obvious things is that where riparian areas are taken care of, fenced in some most occasions, is that the riparians respond and are healthy, better for fish. If they're not taken care of, it's not good for fish. Again, when we look at the system, especially when you're looking at, this year we have one of the record runs coming back of adult fish. And we're also going to have a very poor water year. What are we going to do as citizens of four states to help ourselves, protect not just the Indian way of life and treaties, but our way of life, our quality of life as citizens here? So, again, I appreciate the time here to speak, and I think I've got a little over on Mr. Huber's time. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Louis. Who's Mr. Huber? Be sure and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Audie Huber. I'm Intergovernmental Affairs Manager for the Department of Natural Resources, Confederated Tribes, Umatilla Indian Reservation. I'm here to offer comments on the Umatilla Tribes' recovery efforts in the Umatilla Basin over the last 20 or so years. But to begin, I'd like to give a brief overview, as Louis had conducted, on treaty law, basic Indian Law 101. To start out with the proposition, the tribes negotiated a treaty back in 1855. The treaty guaranteed the Umatilla tribe, as it did the Warm Springs tribe, the right to fish at all usual custom fishing stations. We found it over the last few decades that right can be an empty right if there are no fish. States cannot, through inadvertence or intent, abrogate treaty rights by destroying fish habitat or fisheries resources. The treaties themselves are, as noted in the U.S. Constitution, the supreme law of the land. The duties of the federal agencies are to uphold the treaties, and with that, a recognition that treaties were not a grant of rights to the tribes, but a grant to the United States from the tribes that required the U.S. a grant of rights to the United States, the title to land, and reservation of rights by the tribes. There are several statutes that the United States has enacted under its Commerce Clause authority, not just in relation with tribes, but in relation to protection of the environment, including the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act, which both meld into protection of tribal treaty rights. Additionally, there's a trust responsibility of the federal agencies to ensure tribal resources are managed in the tribe's best interest. Because the tribes retain those treaty rights, the property of which is held by the United States often, the U.S. is required to manage those in the best interest of the tribes. Now, next is the duty of the states in their relationship to the tribes. The states do not figure prominently in the relationship between the United States and tribal governments, because under the U.S. Constitution, the United States reserved the right to regulate commerce with Indian tribes. However, the states manage many of the resources that can have a direct impact on treaty rights. It is established law that a state cannot act in a way that would impair or abrogate a treaty right. But it is our intent and effort for the past to partner with state and the federal government in order to protect treaty reserve resources. In a short background of what's going on in the Umatilla Basin, over the last 15 years, since the passage of the Umatilla Basin Act, we've been interacting cooperatively with ODF&W and the federal government, Bonneville Power Administration, to fund hatcheries and to fund salmon restoration efforts in the Umatilla, including the construction of the Umatilla Basin Project, Phases 1 and 2, which acts for a bucket-for-bucket transfer of water rights off the Umatilla and onto the Columbia, so the water that's necessary for salmon migration is in the river when it's needed. Right now, we are in process of developing DMDLs for lower and upper Umatilla River. However, it's unknown what relationship that will have between water, water quality and water quantity. That's going to need a careful attention on the part of the tribes, the feds, and the state, because there's a direct correlation between salmon survival and water quality and quantity. Right now, on the Umatilla Basin, we are participating in sub-basin planning through the Northwest Power Planning Council process, not through House Bill 3609. We have implemented a successful co-management scheme in the Umatilla Basin. The Department of Natural Resources for the Umatilla Tribe employs over 100 staff. The tribe itself employs over 1,000. 40 members of the staff in DNR work in fisheries. We comprehensively manage resources on the reservation on the 6.3 million acres of ceded territory. Other programs we work with are cultural resources, environmental planning, rights protection, water resources, special sciences and resources program, which deals with Hanford and Umatilla Army Depot, as well as wildlife. By way of background, the salmon went extinct in the Umatilla Basin almost 80 years ago due to agricultural practices. The rivers were running dry, and there was very low water quality. Over the last 20 years, the CQIR, the ODFW, and Bonneville Power Administration have established a hatchery network, a key element of a comprehensive fish restoration program in the upper Umatilla that have brought salmon back to the river. We have not focused solely on supplementation of natural production through use of hatcheries, but we've had to concentrate on all ages, the hatchery, habitat, hydro mitigation, and harvest. Currently, the Umatilla River is the only tributary above Bonneville in Oregon with a fairly consistent non-Indian sports fishery for salmon. This is a lot to be said for the Umatilla tribe. Their primary goal has been to bring back salmon to fishable, harvestable levels. In 1995, four Columbia Basin treaty tribes, Yakima, Nez Perce, Umatilla, and Warm Springs, authored Wakanishmi-Wakishwit, The Spirit of the Salmon, a scientifically reviewed strategy for the recovery of salmon that has served as the tribal model for implementing salmon restoration. We have worked as co-managers throughout the basin, not just the Umatilla Basin, but through the Columbia Basin, working on other rivers such as the Walla Walla, the Umnaha, the Grand Ronde, and the Touche. Last session, I'm sure many of you are aware, we worked on House Bill 3609, which sought to achieve a balance between the wild fish management policy and the necessity to use hatcheries to support natural production. And as my esteemed colleague from our office, Gary James, would point out, any fish manager will tell you wild fish beats a hatchery fish, but there are some basins where we're not given a choice. We're dealing with salmon runs that are two or three fish. And at that point, we need to have some flexibility in implementing using hatchery efforts to supplement natural production. And on the Umatilla Basin, we have a strong cooperative working relationship with ODFW. We would like to see that working relationship translated to Walla Walla and Grand Ronde on all ages for salmon recovery. We've found in our interactions with the state on the policy level that hatcheries are used to address mitigation only. All money is going to hatcheries to supplement harvest rather than restoration. We're dealing with concrete to concrete management. Send the salmon out of the hatcheries and they come back to the hatcheries. What we've done is we've outplanted native stock where possible into the habitat that's available and allow those to return to the gravel. It's gravel to gravel management. We found that working under some plans, I'll use the Oregon plan as an example, working under that plan, a commitment to a plan like that that does not reflect the views of all the co-managers is problematic because it thwarts co-management by setting the plan in stone. While there is a distinction between wild fish and hatchery fish, If it's a hatchery fish, 20th generation, that are bred solely for their desirability as in the sports fishery, then yes, there is a distinction. But when we've used hatcheries to keep that genetic diversity in the basin, and the Umatilla, we were only able to restore salmon because the salmon went extinct. Had we had they not been extinct, we would have run up against wild fish management policy. Finally, through co-management, we can restore salmon like we have in the Umatilla Basin. It's important that any legislation that attempts to legislatively cement the Oregon Plan include direction to work with the tribes as co-managers. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Mason. I'm a tribal lobbyist for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. I do also happen to be an attorney with a specialty in Indian law, and I've been practicing for 18 years, most of that time representing Oregon tribes, but also a stint in Idaho representing tribes and working also for the United States in the Department of the Interior. Just a two or three points I want to make real quickly so you can hear from other folks. Basically, we think the principles of the Oregon Plan are consistent with the 1855 treaties. The effort to improve watershed health and restore salmon and marine creatures is something that was understood by the Indian signers of the treaties as to be unnecessary because they had no idea if things would come to this pass. However, as Mr. Huber has mentioned, we have serious concerns about the wild fish policy, feel that the way it has been applied, the way it was written and the way it's been applied, and in disregard of the treaties on the Columbia River and its tributaries in particular, and it created a rigidity in dealing with salmon problems that we felt required legislative correction, which is why we asked for House Bill 3609 and supported House Bill 3609 that was co-sponsored by members of this committee and now Senator Jason Atkinson. That need was underlined by the collapse of the Columbia River Fish Management Plan talks conducted under the auspices of the USB Oregon case, and those talks have yet to resume, and the production issue is critical. And you'll hear more from Mr. Sampson and Mr. Platt about what tribes see as necessary to really restore salmon. I would mention in connection with House Bill 3609, which is really an acknowledgement of treaty rights, that you'll hopefully soon be seeing Senate Bill 214 come over to this chamber, which removes the sunset from 3609, which otherwise would have 3609 fall flat on June 30th. So that'll be coming over, and that'll give us an opportunity to get done with plans. I wanted to second to the point that Mr. Huber made about working closely with ODFW locally, both in the Hood Basin, the Deschutes Basin, John Day Basin. We have a positive working relationship. I think we're very close to a plan under 3609 and under the Northwest Power Planning Council process that will provide for flexibility in the production of salmon, where we can use wild fish eggs in the hatchery, experimental hatchery on the Hood River, and we have high hopes for restoration of salmon in that basin as a result. I'll make one last point. It's particularly significant, I think, for this legislature to support what we call the Stevens-Palmer treaties that were made in 1855. Governor Stevens of the Washington Territory and Joel Palmer, the Indian agent for the Oregon Territory at the time, really did a whirlwind tour of the Northwest, starting on the coast, ending up at Hell's Gate, or Missoula, as it's more pleasantly named today. I don't know why they made that change, but anyway, making treaties with all the tribes along that route. I say it's particularly important because Joel Palmer was not only the founder of Dayton, but he was a speaker of this house. And he was the one who recognized that the tribes would not sign treaties without the protection of their fishing rights in those treaties. And it was Palmer who came up with language so significant to tribes, the in common with the citizens of the United States language preserving fishing rights off reservation. So with that, any of us would be happy to answer questions. And very much appreciate the opportunity to present to the committee, and thank you in advance for your consideration of these important issues that so deeply affect the tribes.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I really appreciate you being here and sharing with us. We'll open for questions if we have any questions. Well, this is a timid committee for you here today.
Don't get them riled up.
Okay, thank you. We'll
thank you, committee.
Go on. At this point, we have Don Sampson. And you have some other folks with you there, Don. I'll let Walter introduce you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm pleased to be here again to give just a brief overview of some strategies that are ongoing in the Columbia Basin that may be useful to Oregon's planning and implementation of the Oregon Plan. With me today is my special assistant, Mr. John Platt, and Matt Johnson, who works as our legislative researcher. And so he's tracking what's going on here in Salem. What I've provided you are two items. First is, I'm sorry.
For the record, you're
not. I'm sorry. My name is Donald Sampson. I'm the executive director of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. And I work on behalf of the Warm Springs, Umatilla, Nez Perce, and Yakima Nation.
Thank you.
They are the four treaty tribes in the Columbia River Basin. Mr. Chairman, what I'm providing is a copy of a peer-reviewed article that was published in the Journal of the American Water Resources Association, and it's entitled Anadromous Salmonid Recovery in the Umatilla River Basin of Oregon, a Case Study. And I provided that to you because we wanted to present an all-age strategy that incorporated the use of habitat restoration, passage and water restoration in the Umatilla, use of hatchery supplementation done appropriately, as well as harvest limitations. And so this is the one that was completed, and it's for your reference, because this project and what has gone on in the Umatilla, I believe, is an example of what was intended to occur in the Oregon Plan. And if you recall that the Oregon Plan has four key elements. One is investments in local solutions. That's something that was done here. Planning was done by Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Confederate Tribes of Umatilla. Senator Hatfield led that effort in terms of federal funding, and we worked very closely with representatives and local folks in the Umatilla Basin. The other element was, as identified in the Oregon Plan, is private and public partnerships. You will see in here work between soil conservation districts, irrigation districts, tribes, local citizens, watershed councils, and state agencies and federal agencies. Third is called in the Oregon Plan a science-based watershed management. This is probably the first time in the state of Oregon where the scientists collectively put together a plan and began to implement it, and they use at the time their best available science. Of course, the science is always evolving as we learn new things. And then last is the implementation of existing law. In this case, they were able to meet not only the statutes of the state of Oregon, but also the treaty statutes that Louis Pitt and Audie Huber were referring to. In addition, they're now meeting some of the compliance requirements of the Endangered Species Act, as well as state water law and treaty water rights. So I think this is a very good example to review, look at the science behind it, and in my mind represents what the intent was of the Oregon Plan. There's some key approaches that are identified in the Oregon Plan, and it says this, that this approach meshes scientifically sound actions with local watershed-based public support. Now, let me rewind a few years ago. It was almost 10 years ago when the state agencies, the tribes, and the federal agencies in the Columbia River Basin began what was called sub-basin planning. And we put together documents, plans, for every river basin in the Columbia, and we had goals, objectives. We identified how we would restore habitat, how we would use hatcheries, how we would rebuild natural spawning populations, how we would improve conditions for passage. We went through the whole thing, including harvest in those tributaries. Well, those plans were shelved some 10 years ago, and today the Northwest Power Planning Council, which is comprised of the four states, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana, are now undertaking a new effort. As was mentioned earlier, the four Columbia River Treaty tribes picked those old plans off the shelf, updated them, and put together our plan back in 1995. And that is the basis for our strategies. The second paper I provided you is a strategic planning concept paper. And this will bring you to where we're at today in the Columbia Basin in terms of state efforts and tribal efforts. And I think there's some significant actions that have occurred most recently that relate to the Oregon Plan and how it could be implemented. If you look at the first page, and particularly the area called goals, and it states there, in the treaties and other federal and state laws establish goals for anadromous fish that are authoritative. So that's really what guides us. In case of treaties, the right to take fish at all usual and custom fishing places provides a goal. That's a contract. The Regional Act, which is the Northwest Power Planning Act, contains a goal to mitigate, protect, and enhance fish and wildlife affected by any hydroelectric project. That's what your representatives to the Northwest Power Planning Council are working on, Eric Block and John Bergiotti. So what has happened most recently that is significant? I believe two things. One is that the tribes in 1995 established a common goal, and that was 5 million salmon within 25 years. Now, I don't know if that's part of the Oregon Plan, if we've laid out a numeric goal for salmon restoration in the state of Oregon. I don't believe it is. The other thing is that we identified a time frame to achieve those goals, and that's very important. If we know where we want to go and how long we want to get there, then we ought to spell it out right up front. So our four tribal governments came together with that goal, and we have a two-volume plan that lays out how to achieve it, both a very broad, scientific-based, cultural-based, and legally-based document, and then we went into very specific river basin by river basin plans. If you look at the on that same page, we have the Northwest Power Planning Council. At the by the leadership of Oregon representatives, the state of Oregon moved forward a similar goal as the tribe's goal, and that is 5 million salmon in 25 years. That's the first time that we've had a common goal in the basin. The first time. The states, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana, and our four treaty tribes now have the same goal. You've probably read about it. Nobody knows who's going where. Nobody has a common goal. Well, the tribes and the states have a common goal. That's a big plus. So where are we at now? Right now we're in the planning process to begin figuring out how we're going to rebuild each of these units, these river basins, and that's what we call sub-basin biological objectives. And basically what we're talking about is, all right, in the Umatilla, how many fish are going to be produced there, whether that be natural production, hatchery production, combined production? How are we going to improve the habitat? How are we going to restore water? All of these things will be laid out in these sub-basin biological objectives. If you'll turn to the second page, once we have established these biological objectives, then we have to put together strategies and actions to achieve those. And what we will be doing is working in the basin over the next couple of years to establish those strategies and actions. As I mentioned earlier, we now have a goal of 5 million fish in 25 years for those areas above Bonneville Dam, but now we've got to get into the building blocks. So 10,000 fish in this basin, 50,000 fish in this basin ought to equate to 5 million fish, and in a 25-year period. And then we have to be able to link the objectives that we have for each of those basin with strategies. And we have a number of models that we can do that with. So I'll turn you to the next page, and it's kind of a simple model, and I think it's very understandable. We have our common goals here on top. The states and the tribes have common goals. How does the Oregon plan fit into those goals? How does Oregon, the river basins in Oregon along the Columbia, fit into achieving these goals? That's one question that you will have to ask. And then we go to each river basin, and you have an example, the Umatilla River. We say there, here's where our objectives. Some nearly 50,000 fish returning. Well, we're in the last 15 years, we've had as many as 15,000 fish. We've gone from zero to 15,000 fish. So we're on our way to achieving those goals, and it was from a plan, a sub-basin plan that we agreed upon some time ago. And as it was the tribe and the states that put that plan together. And then we'll develop strategies, strategy A, strategy B, strategy C. And it's a particularly important, back to the Oregon plan, is that we get partnerships. The people in the river basins have to agree to be able to implement these plans. They have to have the buy-in because they're the folks going to live there down the road. So, Mr. Chairman, I guess the last attachment to this, and then I'll conclude, is that we've laid out a strategy for the tribes to take the lead in particular sub-basins, actually be the lead riders in a particular basin, such as the Umatilla, such as the Deschutes, and that we would co-lead with the state of Oregon, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and other river basins. We're basically divvying up the responsibilities and the roles, recognizing that we have to work together to do that. But what we need is these sub-basin plans, and basically it would be a plan that tells you the strategy, what specific actions, the time frames for implementing those, and the cost. That's where we need to go if we're going to succeed. Further on, we talk about how we'll work with the stakeholders in each of the basins. We talk about the assessment tools we'll use to determine what strategies would work best. And then last, we talk about the benefit risks. And this deals with the issue of hatcheries as well as the populations, the natural populations. What are the risks associated with using hatcheries to supplement either existing wild populations or using those fish that are now reared in hatcheries and putting them back in the wild to spawn? What are the benefits of those? And then how do we evaluate those in the long term? Last, we'll be looking at resident fish as well as wildlife, and then we'll be working over the next 2 to 3 years to pull these plans together and start implementing them. So, Mr. Chairman, that's kind of the status of things in the basin. I know that there's the original Oregon plan focused primarily on coastal coho, that now they're talking about steelhead across the state, but we've really got to get to these specific sub-basin actions in order to get it effectively implemented. That's all.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Sanford, when you come up with these numbers, it seems that you're less concerned if these are native salmon or hatchery salmon. Is that true?
Well, no, what we do is in each particular basin, we'll assess what the wild population is. For example, of course, the preference is for wild populations, natural spawning populations. But if there are existing populations, for example, in Umatilla, where there were zero fish, or where the abundance was such that they could not rebuild, then we would come in and establish some supplementation program using artificial propagation. But it is important that you look at basin by basin, what the current status of the population is.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Reverend King.
When you use supplementation, when you've got a wild population that's down, can you give me a little characterization of your build back up? The concern there would be that, you know, a wild population would be overwhelmed by a supplementation population.
Some of the ideas that are currently being proposed are, one, we've got to look at the status of the population and the decline over the past few years. Where is the trend leading us? And what actions are we prepared to implement to reverse that? If it was strictly a wild population, what actions are we prepared to implement to reverse the decline and actually rebuild it? And how long will that occur? How long will it take if we implement these habitat actions? So that's one of the first things we look at. The second thing is the viability of that population. For example, if you have 5 fish spawning, then you should be concerned about inbreeding. That population begins to inbreed, so you got to look at the genetic viability of the population. The other thing is that today people are looking at hatcheries much more differently than we did in the past. In the past, hatcheries were just kind of pump them out, put them out into the fishery, and return them back. And that's the old style, the concrete-to-concrete management that is now being kind of moved aside. But today we have new supplementation hatcheries, such as on the Yakima Indian Nation. They've got one of the state-of-the-art hatcheries that tries to mimic the wild population in terms of its life history, in terms of its run timing, in terms of the male to female ratios. Whatever we can do to try to mimic that natural population, that is the intent. That's where the hatcheries are moving today. So I think we look at it very seriously in terms of genetic impacts, but we also look at it in terms of the risks if we don't do something of these populations going extinct. I don't know if I answered your question or not. Maybe another time. Run it by me again, and I'll.
We'll have another time.
Thank you, gentlemen. I think as far as the chair is concerned, while I certainly don't want to say that the solution or the efforts that we've reached on the Umatilla are the only and the absolute and final thing that we may do, but one of the issues, points that I'd like to make with the committee, with your, is that this was a river where the salmon were extinct. We're not talking about endangered. We're not talking about threatened. There weren't any salmon left. And the program that Don is mentioning for you has returned a viable, I think, fisheries to the Umatilla. In the last year, I believe they had a sporting fishery, 600 fish for Native Americans, the Indian population, and 600 fish for the white population in the Umatilla. We'd like to catch a lot more salmon than that. But that ain't bad for a river that a few years ago the fish were extinct in. So I think that, certainly something that deserves our careful consideration as we look at the myriad of problems that we have to look at in relationship to the species recovery.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just respond. In this paper, and this is why I brought it to you, and maybe it gets to your question, Representative King, is that we did have wild steelhead populations there. Steelhead are salmon. They were wild. They maintained themselves at about a 1,500 return every year. And what we did is we supplemented that population very carefully. We took some of the wild returning fish, reared them in a hatchery. We made sure that they were as close to the wild population as we could in terms of rearing of them. And what we have found, and what's published in this report, is that the run timing and the genetic stock composition of the two components which is the hatchery reared and the natural spawning steelhead, have not differed at all. Now, you'll see things that are, people say, well, there's a big difference. But in this case, we did it very carefully and very selectively, and we found that the run timing and the genetic composition were the same. So that's important to note. And these are changes that we're implementing right now. The tribes are taking the lead in terms of the change in hatchery operations in this basin, and I think this is an example of that.
Colleagues, we'll look forward, I think it's in May, when we have a salmon walk on the Umatilla, and we're hopeful that we may be able to participate in the salmon walk at that time. Any other questions?
What is the salmon walk?
Well, we walk up the North Fork of the Umatilla and watch the salmon, watch the spawning. Thank you. At this point, Christine McNitt with the Oregon Water Resources Congress. Break today, Christine. Your predecessor isn't here to.
Rather intimidating.
Welcome. Thanks for being.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt with the Oregon Water Resources Congress. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you about our Congress and our experiences and perspectives with respect to the Oregon Plan. OWRC is a statewide nonprofit trade association representing different types of member users, including water supply districts, irrigation districts, water control, ports, drainage, and other water improvement districts. When the Oregon Water Resources Congress first incorporated, its stated mission was to, and I quote, promote the development, control, conservation, preservation, and utilization of land and water resources of the state of Oregon. That was in 1912. As an association with a solid and early history of working to mesh scientific information, increase efficiency measures, and applied on-the-ground efforts of local districts, OWRC's fit with the general approach of the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds was relatively comfortable since its inception. OWRC produces comprehensive policy workbooks on a number of issues, operating policies and procedures for districts, easement protection workbooks, conservation plan guidelines, and water law guidance. Most districts belong to their local watershed councils and assist their members in education regarding water quality management, or the so-called 10-10 plans, as we view those as insurance protecting water rights within the arena of water quality. Most districts also have conservation plans in place. Additionally, OWRC works with the Bureau of Reclamation in coordination and implementation of projects in both the planning and the implementation stages. Some projects are assisting in development of water conservation plans, on-the-ground conservation projects, water leasing, water measurement, and other type joint programs. Some specific examples I'll lay before you in the Tumalo Irrigation District, located between Bend and Sisters. Conservation project expenditures from 1995 through 1999 totaled more than $2.6 million. The district has aggressively converted open distribution canals to underground pressurized pipelines in order to eliminate seepage. That way they provide enough water to meet irrigation requirements and guarantee minimum water levels in Tumalo Creek. The same irrigation district is now looking at another project replacing six segments of open canal with pipeline for an estimated total of $4 million. In the North Unit, an irrigation district near Madras, canal lining conservation efforts have annually saved 20,000 acre-feet of water. Two separate piping projects have saved a combined total of 2,000 acre-feet of water. Approximately 50% of the total conserved water, the so-called new water, is then available for purchase or lease to augment stream flows, enhancing watershed and wildlife habitat. Overall, OWRC supports the philosophy and approach of the Oregon Plan and has no wholesale changes to submit, but continued emphasis on several key issues remain. Maintaining emphasis on the role of local citizens as resource stewards responsible for watershed restoration activities on privately owned land, funding for data collection and scientific information on species habitat and the impacts of farming on the environment, coordinating administrative agencies to make data and regulations consistent and user-friendly, and two very important factors, finding a mechanism to provide the federal government with accurate and persuasive arguments that we as Oregonians can manage our resources without federal or judicial intervention. And finally, to analyze the Oregon system of water rights to find alternatives that will allow our state to continue recognizing and enforcing prior appropriation systems while providing water users with ways to operate within some degree of regulatory certainty and accommodate the Endangered Species Act. Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about Oregon water resources and the Oregon plan. I know I'm not talking about salmon. Everyone else is talking about salmon today. We actually have some applied experiences with the Oregon plan. I just wanted to report to you a little bit of what our members are doing.
Thank you very much, Christina. We do appreciate that if we are talking about water, I'm told that we're talking about salmon, too. I believe your testimony is not inappropriate in that regard, and we do appreciate you being here. Questions?
Thank you.
A quiet committee here. We come up a little bit here. At this point, we have Metro Regional Services, Rod Park and Ken Helm. And we seem to have brought some reinforcements, so.
I probably need them.
Oh.
Hey, thank you for having us here, Chair Jensen and the committee. My name is Rod Park. I'm a Metro Counselor, and I'm representing the council here today before you. We appreciate your invitation to appear before the committee. I want to give you an overview of Metro, who we are, what we do, and our current efforts related to salmon and steelhead recovery in our region. Ken Helm is here to my left, who works out of our Office of General Counsel and works on our Metro resource issues. And I think you all know Doug Riggs from PacWest, who also represents Metro. Well, what is Metro? Metro serves 24 cities and the urban portions of three counties in the Portland metropolitan area. This is approximately half of Oregon's population. Metro was created by the voters back in 1978 and then reaffirmed in 1992. The voters approved a home rule charter outlining Metro's primary responsibilities for the region. That charter requires Metro to undertake several important regional functions: operation of the solid waste disposal system, operation of the Oregon Zoo, the Oregon Convention Center, the Expo Center, and the Performing Arts Center for Portland, management of regional park system and open spaces, along with the pioneer cemeteries, planning for the regional land use issues. The voters of the region have supported numerous bond measures related to these regional functions. In 1986, the voters approved a $65 million bond measure to build the Oregon Convention Center. In 1990, the voters approved a $5.1 million permanent tax base for the Oregon Zoo. In 1995, the voters approved a $135 million bond measure to acquire lands for open space in the region. Metro's planning responsibilities. Like Bend, Medford, LeGrand, Coquille, and other local governments, Metro is part of Oregon's land use planning system. Within the system, Metro is responsible for adopting and managing an urban growth boundary for the Portland metropolitan region. The Metro Charter and state law place responsibility on Metro to conduct regional planning on issues like transportation, housing, parks and open spaces, water and air quality within that urban growth boundary. In 1995, the planning responsibilities culminated in a general plan for the Metro region called the 2040 Growth Concept. And in your purple notebooks, there's a one that looks like this. It's a green overview you may want to take a look at. The growth concept integrates transportation planning, urban planning, and fish and wildlife planning. It is within this context that Metro will be working with other local governments to recover salmon and steelhead. What is Metro doing for fish? Metro and our local partners of 24 cities and three counties recognize the need to wisely manage land with near our streams and rivers This was prior to the National Marine Fisheries Service's involvement, but has become, as you know, even more urgent now. Metro plans that implement the growth concept that you'll find in that book require that we apply the statewide planning goal 5 in our fish and wildlife habitat planning, just like all other local governments. We are currently in the midst of inventorying our local streams as required by this goal. This inventory should show us where our time and effort will best spent to help recover salmon. The Goal 5 process is a long one. We anticipate finishing that process by the end of 2002. The 4D rule. NIMS listing of the lower Columbia salmon and steelhead as threatened species and its subsequent adoption of the 4D rule last year caught Metro in the middle of its Goal 5 process. Initially, we thought it was advantageous to act quickly to secure some of the protection for our local partners.